We are up to Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Bet. We are moving along through the early Shoftim. It's going around. It's going around. Pasuk Yud Bet. I warn you in advance. This next story gets a little graphic. So, it is what it is. It is what it is. We will learn it, but it does get a little graphic. Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael la'asot tara b'nei Hashem. Iteration, cycle, a generation later, idolatry. Vayechazek Hashem et eglon melech Moav al Yisrael ki asu et tara b'nei Hashem. The next iteration, the enemy that God allows to have power or control over Israel, is Eglon Melech Moab. And if you look at the map for a moment, just to familiarize ourselves with the geographic centers that are important for Shoftim. Essentially, we've said many times, the orange is Israelite. Surrounding them on all sides are various different nationalities. So we had already Aram Naharaim or Kushan Rishatayim, which either down south but more likely up north. If we go through the region, down in the south in the Negev, you have the various nomadic tribes, Midian, which are actually way out here. Can you see this little part of the map where it says Midian?
Shender in front of me.
Oh, Shender in front of me. Okay, down here, where it says Midian. Right, that's the broader map. Anybody recognize where this is today?
Iran? No.
No, this should be Saudi Arabia. Should be.
It should be.
Either it is or it isn't. But Midian is down here in the south. You also have nomadic tribes of Amalek in the region. That's when Bnei Yisrael come up from the south. Right, this is Sinai. When Bnei Yisrael come up from the south, they encounter Amalek here in the Negev. So there you have Amalek, Midian. Over here, you see where it says Moab. This region all the way around, the yellow on the outside of this Ever HaYarden region of orange, that was the area that originally belonged to Ammon and Moab. This is the original territory of Ammon and Moab, the city of Ammon here, Rabat Bnei Ammon, Cheshbon, which was the capital of Moab. It was back in Chumash time, in Parshat Chukat, we know that this was conquered originally by Sichon, king of Amori. And Bnei Yisrael conquered it from Sichon. That was the famous battle of Sichon. So that's this region here, thereby pushing Ammon and Moab out of their original territory, one to the east, one to the south. So Ammon is generally identified here in the east, and Moab down south, although they are connected. And the connection between Ammon and Moab we will address later in the course. As you go further up, you get to the area of the Bashan and the Hermon, which we talked earlier about Aram Naharaim, and then up here is Lebanon. So when we talk about Moab or Ammon, we're talking about an encounter with a force that starts from the east. The difference in Ammon and Moab, on the one hand, and Midian, Amalek, Bnei Kedem, on the other, is that Ammon and Moab have a regional territory. They have an area. Whereas Amalek, Midian, and those tribes are generally more nomadic. And so they'll come from different locations. Vayechazek Hashem et eglon melech Moav al Yisrael al ki asu et tara b'nei Hashem. Vayesof elav et bnei Amon va'amalek. So this Eglon, king of Moab, gathers together with him a force that includes bnei Amon. And Ammon and Moab will often go together, and there's no surprise there. Why? Why am I not surprised that Ammon and Moab would go together? Well, they're geographically together, but why else? Why are Ammon and Moab always linked?
They're brothers.
They are brothers. Right? They have a common ancestry. Ammon and Moab are the two sons of Lot and his daughters. So they are cousin nations, and you'll find them constantly in being referenced together. Different periods of time, one leading the other, but certainly together. Eglon, king of Moab, gathers together forces with Ammon, and with him he takes Amalek. No surprise there. Amalek will always find their way into the fray. Vayelach vayach et Yisrael vayirshu et ir hatmarim. They went, they made wage war with Israel, and they conquered the city of Ir hatmarim. What's Ir hatmarim?
Palm trees.
What city is known as Ir hatmarim, the city of palms? This is not Palm Springs, nor is it San Diego. It's certainly not Las Vegas.
It's not Palm Beach.
Yericho. Correct. Yericho is referred to as Irat Marim. Yericho is referred to as Irat Marim in a number of places in Tanakh. In Devarim is the first reference. Et Negev, et Kikar, et Yericho, Ir HaTmarim. Yericho, Ir HaTmarim. Have you ever been to the area of Yericho?
Mm-hmm.
You see the palms?
Mm-hmm.
It's Yericho is an oasis. It's built on underground springs. And oases? Oasis, plural. Oasis in the plural. Many of them.
Crises.
Okay. Oases are built upon. Are often built on. Are often cities of palms because that's how the palms grow in the desert, from these underground springs. Palm Springs is no different, and many of these. City. So Yericho is referred to in Tanakh as Ir HaTmarim. Now that's an interesting observation, because geographically, for Ammon and Moab to conquer Yericho means that the forces of Ammon and Moab have to come from which direction?
In the sense, have
to come from the south, more likely from the
east,
which is why the previous pasuk says that Moab takes with him Vayesof Elav Bnei Amon. In other words, it's not just a collegiate alliance, it's a strategic alliance. Because to get from here to here, you have to cut across this way. Much easier than conquering your way this way. So it cuts across from the east, comes into Yericho. If he's sitting in Yericho, it means he already has control of Ever Hayarden. And now he's taking control of this area here. Open parentheses, FYI, Yericho itself is an uninhabited city. Why is Yericho an uninhabited city? And then Yeshua made a declaration or an oath that nobody was allowed to rebuild Yericho. That oath does not get violated until the days of. Remember, we looked at it last 2 years ago. Right, that oath doesn't get violated until the days of Achav. Achav is the first one to rebuild the city of Yericho. So it's unlikely that it's the city of Yericho per se that he conquers as much as the region. So now Ammon and his army are sitting here in the kishkas, if you will, of Bnei Israel. Vayavdu Bnei Israel et Eglon Melech Moab Shmon Esrei Shena. That situation, loss of sovereignty, tax or tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, lasts for 18 years. Vayiz Akub Bnei Yisrael El Hashem, Vayakom Hashem Lahem Moshiach. They cried out to God, and God sent them a Moshiach, et Ehud ben Gera ben Hayemini. Ehud ben Gera ben Hayemini. Ben Hayemini means from Binyamin, right? Reuven Reuveni, Shimon Shimoni, Binyamin. Instead of saying Binyamin Binyamani, you say Ben Hayemini. Correct. Now, before I finish this pasuk, up until this point, these four psukim essentially have reviewed for us virtually the same structure that we've had up until now. From Perek Bet, which was the schematic, through the iteration of Otniel ben Knaz, the schematic of the sequence of events has been identical. Bnei Yisrael sinned, political enemy in order as a punishment. Bnei Yisrael cry out to Hashem. After a period of time, they realize their sin, they cry out to Hashem, and Hashem responds through the appointment or designation or inspiration of a shofet. What begins to change here now is the details of the story, because up until now, in the case of Otniel ben Knaz, we had no details of how he led the battle. What changes here is that the rest of this parak is going to give us the battle plan. What exactly happened, and how did Ehud ben Gera lead them through this campaign? Ish iter yad yemino. This Ehud ben Gera ben hayemini meaning from Binyamin, was an iter yad yemin. Iter yad yemin is a very interesting phrase. It literally translates as weakened right hand. It's actually, I don't know if it's a pejorative. It's not a pejorative in context.
No.
It's not meant as a pejorative. It's meant as, it's the Tanakh term for somebody who is left-handed. Because how do you define somebody who's left-handed? Right? Describe it. Today, we have a whole different perspective on left-handed, right-handed, left-handedness, because we have a more scientific approach to it. But up until 100 years ago, left-handed people were considered
evil,
an abnormality.
How many people here are left-handed?
It was considered abnormal. Right? Some people were forced.
My mother would be that general, you're talking about 90-something years ago. Her brothers could write lefty, but she was not allowed to write lefty. She had to write righty.
They used to try to retrain people. It was considered abnormality. Whether sinister or not, that more superstitious, but it was certainly considered abnormal. However, in this context, it's not referred to as a pejorative or an abnormality. It's described as a reality. And it's a very important reality to understand the story. It's a functional component of the story. This Ehud ben Gera was left-handed. Now, there is no term for left-handed in Tanakh. The term for left-handed is iter yad yemini, meaning a weaker right hand. A weaker right hand means you end up using your
left hand.
So that's the terminology for it.
It's a very fine
That's the way it was. Because again, if your standard is that everybody has a stronger right hand, the abnormal is where your right hand is weaker than your left hand, and so it is iter yad yemini.
So this is value free. It's just a description.
It's a description for us to understand what happens in the rest of the story. It's a description for us to understand what happens in the rest of the story. In warfare, especially if you are fighting sword to sword, left-handed soldiers have a distinct advantage. Because right-handed swordsmen train against right-handed swordsmen. So you're going like this.
Right.
Right-handed swordsmen against left-handed swordsmen, you're coming at it from a different angle. So a left-handed swordsman is used to it because that's how they train and that's how they fight. Whereas a right-handed swordsman is not used to it, and so it's a completely odd angle with which to fight with the sword. And therefore, generally, a left-handed swordsman will have a strategic advantage in direct sword fighter combat. I guess someone was describing it to somebody this morning, and I said it's kind of analogous to a left-handed pitcher, which has distinct advantage in the world of baseball, but for other reasons. Actually, let's take a break for a moment, since we're before the, once I start the story, I sort of want to go through the story as a whole, as a uninterrupted. But the notion that Binyamin, that this Eyub ben Gera is described as Ben Yamini, meaning he comes from Shevet Binyamin, and is Iter Yad Yamin, and he is of weaker right hand. I always find it ironic that Eyub ben Gera from Binyamin is described as Iter Yad Yamin. And the reason it's ironic is because the expression Iter Yad Yamin appears only twice in Tanakh. This is the first time. The second time, what would be a shir in Tanakh if we didn't go flipping, right? The second time is also in Shoftim, in Perek Chaf. In the story of Pelegesh Bekiva, where you have the battle between Shevet Binyamin and the rest of Bnei Yisrael. And there it says, Pasuk Tet Vav, Vayitpakdu Bnei Binyamin Bayom Ahu Meha'arim 26,000 Ish Shalef Charev. Binyamin gathered together from all of the cities 26,000 soldiers who drawers of the sword, which essentially means soldiers. Levad mi yoshvei ha-giv'ah hitpaktu 700 ish bachor, and the city of Giv'ah itself, another 700. Mikol ha-amezeh 700 ish bachor iter yad yimino. And of these 27,700, 700 of them were left-handed. Kol zeh kolea be'evin al-asara v'lo yachatin. Not only were they left-handed, but they were sharpshooters. Marksmen. They could hit the target, bullseye. Kole ela matara ela be'evin ela sara v'lo yachti. They could hit a hair with a stone and not miss. Sharpshooters. Now, the context of the sharpshooters for the battle with Binyamin is not our issue, but it's interesting that this is the second time in Tanakh where you have a reference to Iter Yad Yamin, left-handed soldier, both in the context of battle, right, both in the context of Shalev Cherev as an advantage, and both from Shevet Binyamin. So it's interesting that there seems to be a disposition within Shevet Binyamin towards left-handedness, which of course wouldn't surprise us because it would be considered a genetic trait. The irony is that it's of all of the Shvatim in Tanakh identified as left-handed, the one that is so identified is Dafka Shevet Binyamin. But that's the irony of it, because the whole essence of being of Binyamin is a story about the right hand. Right, that's the irony of it. Right, when Binyamin is named, that's why I thought I would take a moment or a parenthetical aside. Do we ever discuss the naming of Binyamin?
You did.
Yeah. We talked about the naming of Binyamin. Naming of Binyamin is a remarkable story, because you have the only place in Tanakh that I recall. I think it's the only place where you have a difference of opinion between father and mother as to how to name the child.
Yeah.
Right? She calls the child, as she's dying, as Rachel is dying in childbirth, she names him Ben Oni. Ve'aviv karalo Binyamin. She names him Ben Oni. Ve'aviv karalo Binyamin, and his father named him Binyamin. And there's a fascinating machloket amongst the mafarshim. What does ben oni mean? Well, that's the question. We're going to get to the translation. The translations are unclear. That's what the mafarshim discuss. What does the word ben oni mean? And why would Yaakov change it to Binyamin? So, for example, and I gave you three sample interpretations on the source page. The first is Rashi. Rashi says ben oni means ben sa'ari. We do this one at some point or another. I'm just going to do this quickly and review it because for the sake of everybody. Ben oni, ben sa'ari, the son of my anguish. Binyamin, why does Yaakov call him Binyamin? So Yaakov calls him Binyamin, near Abbe Naila Fishahu Levadon Olad Be'eretz Canaan. Since Binyamin was the only one to be born in the land of Canaan, he refers to him as Ben Yamin. Rashi has this notion that geographically you refer to the south as Yamin and the north as small, which would only work if you're looking at the maps facing east. Right? We draw maps facing north. Evidently, in Rashi's time, they drew maps facing east, and therefore Yamin would refer to the south or to Eretz Yisrael. And he quotes a pasuk, Tzafon v'yamin atavratam, you created the north and the Yamin, which would be the south. And therefore he says, yeah, she calls him Ben Oni, meaning she's dying in childbirth, so she names him the son of my sa'ar, my anguish, my pain. Yaakov didn't want to walk around with this child stigmatized by the death of Rachel, so he renames him to something a little more uplifting, a little more significant, a little more spiritual. Ben Yamin, according to Rashi, would be the biblical equivalent to what we would refer to as Ben Sion. The son born in Eretz Yisrael, meaning the son born in the south, or in this case, we would refer to as Ben Sion, somebody, right, son of Sion. When we named Shmuel Ben Sion, it was the last son we had in Israel before we were going on Shlichut, and that's precisely why we included the name Ben Sion. So that would have been the Rashi's understanding of what Binyamin is, the equivalent of Ben Sion, son of Israel, son of who was born in Eretz Yisrael. Eshbam says that Binyamin means Ben Zkunim, Ben Yamim. Ben Yamim. Aramaic and Hebrew, the Nun and Mem interchange. And therefore, Benyamin could be Binyamin. She refers to him as Ben Oni, again, probably ostensibly because of her pain and her anguish. Yaakov says, no, that's not appropriate. Let's refer to him as the Ben Zkunim, the son of my old age. Which I've always been intrigued by, because there's only 6 years between Yosef and Reuven. And the oldest in Yosef, there's only 6 years. So it's an issue by itself.
How many years between Yosef and Binyamin?
Sorry, there's 6 years between Yosef and Binyamin. There's 6 years between Yosef and Binyamin. Right. Yosef is the last one born before the 6 years where he works. There's 6 years between Yosef and the 7 years between Reuven and Yosef.
That's still harder.
Because there's four wives. The third interpretation is the one that actually has the most compelling interpretation, but it's the most problematic. The Ramban says, what does Ben Oni mean, the son of my anguish? Where does that come from? Meaning, Ben, let's tell him about Ben Evli, the son of my mourning. And Onen is a form of mourning. And he quotes all kinds of psukim from Tanakh that talk about Onim as a form of mourning. Lo chalti ba'onim imenu milechem Onim. And what happened? She, again, from that same context in which she wants to refer to Binyamin as the son of her mourning, her death, her pain, her anguish, her passing. And Yaakov's not prepared to let this child walk through his life with that kind of stigma. Aviv asam min oni kochi. Milashon reshit oni. So, Oni can refer to my strength, Reshit Ono, and Ben, and therefore he turns Ben Oni, he plays the pun on the word Oni. She referred to the word Oni from the root of mourning. Yaakov didn't want that stigma, so he took the word Oni and he played the pun. And he said, Oni also means strength. Well, strength, when you refer to strength, you refer to?
Your right
hand. There's the irony, because Binyamin ends up being the left-handed, the Iter Yad Yamin. But Benyamin, therefore, means the son of my strength, which in Yaakov's mind is a synonym to Ben Oni, but with a different meaning. So whereas, according to Rashi and the Rashbam, Yaakov has to change the name, according to the Ramban, he only has to change the meaning of the name. The name itself remains. And the reason he does so, says the Ramban at the end, Tirgemoto l'tova l'gvura, because he was uncomfortable with this pain associated with Binyamin's name, and so he wanted it to be transformed into something more uplifting, stronger, more positive approach. The reason I think I mentioned this, I don't remember if in the Shira or in Russia, what's always concerned me or bothered me in the context is that here you have Rachel dying, names the child as a reflection of all of her pain, anguish, and suffering, and Yaakov, whose entire life revolves around Rachel, and the remainder of his life revolves around his mourning for Rachel, would Dafka ignore her wishes and change his name to something which would be happy, uplifting, significant, wonderful, beautiful, son of Israel, son of my strength, son. And in the meantime, Rachel dies. It's a moment that's incongruous with the personality of Yaakov. So I heard once from one of my rebbeim that there's a fourth possibility, and that is that the word Yamin here is not a reference to strength or Israel or days, but actually the word Yamin has another meaning in Tanakh. When do you use your right hand? When do you use your right hand? Lift up your right hand. When do you use your right hand? When you vote? When you?
Right.
Right? When you? When do you lift your right hand? Routinely.
Right? Mm-mm.
When you?
Pledge.
When you take an oath. Nishba Hashem bimino uvizroa uzo. God took an oath with his right hand, with the strength of his arm. Nishba tibimin tzidkecha. The notion of Yamin throughout Tanakh is a symbol for an oath. Most famous of that genre is the verse we all are familiar with because we sing it all the time. We just don't necessarily know what it means. Imeshkechech Yerushalayim tishkach yemini tidbak lishoni l'chikim lazkerech. If I forget Jerusalem, my right hand be forgotten. Tishkach yemini. And let my tongue cleave to its palate. What is the symbolism of that statement? The answer is that the psalmist takes an oath to remember Yerushalayim. Im lo alet Yerushalayim arosh simchati. And therefore, im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget Yerushalayim, means if I forget my oath and I violate that oath, then what should happen? The means by which I took that oath should be punished. The means by which I took that oath were my right hand and my tongue. Tidbak tishkach yemini v'tidbak lishoni lechiki. If that's the interpretation of Benjamin, then what's going on here is a debate between Yaakov and Rachel. When Rachel says Ben Oni, what is she essentially referring to?
Maybe when she made that mistake and took her father's
Correct. Aven. The word on can also come from the word aven. Aven means? Aven actually can be spelled both with an ayin and an aleph, although they mean different words, but they're connected. right? Sin, pain, iniquity, mistake. So she essentially says, Ben Oni, meaning, why am I dying? Why is Rachel dying at that moment? Because she stole her father's trephim. And Yaakov stood up and made an oath, whoever took the trephim would die. So she turned, and he didn't know it was her. So she says, at the moment of her death, this son is the son that carries my pain, my iniquity, my mistake, Ben Oni. And Yaakov is not prepared to allow this son, Binyamin, to carry the mistake of Rachel, because it's not her mistake, it's his. So he translates it as Ben Yemini, meaning the son of my oath. And the debate between Yaakov and Rachel over the name of Binyamin is who is to blame for Rachel's death. Rachel says, I took the trephim, it's my fault. And Yaakov says, I took the oath, it's my fault. And that's the debate between Rachel and Yaakov. Now it's a whole different conversation. And he names Binyamin not because he wants to ignore her death, but because at the depth of his love for her, he takes the responsibility for her death on his shoulders and will carry that stigma for the rest of his life.
It's interesting. They both want to take responsibility.
Correct. That's, and that's much more natural. Considering the depth of the love that Yaakov and Rachel had for her, that is a much more natural read of the conversation that could or would have taken place at that time. The other advantage here is that suddenly you understand that the word Yamin means exactly that, Binyamin, right hand. And the irony is that of all the tribes of Israel, only Binyamin is identified as Iter Yad Yamin.
So that has a sense of humor.
Sense of humor, or I was talking to somebody about this morning, and they said, okay, so then, so what? Therefore, so I don't have a therefore. I just think it's ironic.
Observation.
It's an observation.
Well,
I just think it's
give them
powerful.
An advantage in battle.
Yes, but why Dafka? In other words, all of this connects more on the ironic side of it than the substance side. But no. But certainly it does give them the advantage of battle, and they use that advantage both in the story in Pilagish Begiva and here.
But it's not just their behavior to each other. I think it proves what they're doing for their son. I mean, it's not... It's
for Yaakov and Rachel?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he has to carry on from their village, you know?
Sure. Okay, now let's see how far in this, how much of the story itself of Eir's victory we can get through. ויקום להם מושיע את אהוד בן את אהוד בן גירא בן הימיני איש איתר יד ימינו וישלחו בני ישראל בידו מנחה לאגלון מלך מואב. Through his agency they sent a mincha. What's a mincha? A gift offering to Eglon Melech Moab. Why would you send a gift offering to the king who is oppressing you and to whom you owe servitude for 18 years?
Trying to
butter him up? Yeah, a form of...
Bribery.
Excuse me?
Bribery.
In the world of international politics, there's a more... There is a more politically correct term for it.
Tribute.
It's called appeasement. Right? Appeasement.
So this is what happened with Yaakov
and Esav, when Yaakov sent gifts before Esav, correct? Vayas lo Ehud cherev vela shnei fiyot gomed orka. Ehud made a small sword of double blade. Shnei fiyot. P means mouth or blade, in the case of a cherev. There's an expression in Tehillim called cherev pifiot, which means a blade that's double-edged. Hence the expression of double-edged sword. Right? In other words, it's sharp on both sides. Sharp on both sides because it's designed for stabbing, not for cutting. It's a small knife, but it's not a pocket knife designed for cutting. It's a it's a sword designed for fighting, but it's small.
And then it's left and right hand.
And it's left hand, we'll get there. Gomed Orka, it's the size of a gomed, which I'm not sure how big that is, but it's short enough that he can hide it or conceal it. A normal sword that you fight with has to be long enough to keep your enemy at bay. So you have a long sword. That you can't hide so easily. This is a small sword, you can hide it easily. In other words, Ve'achgo ota mitachat lemadav al yerech yimino. And he hid it under his uniform, al yerech, or under his clothes, al yerech yimino, on his right hip. Right. Why is it on his right hip? Because you draw it with your left hand, whereas normally a sword you put on your left hip because you draw it with your
right hand.
Hence the ability to conceal it under his cloak, but nobody's going to expect it there because...
Right?
In other words, if you're standing in front of your enemy and you move your right hand towards your left hip, you're not going to get your hand... Before your hand gets to your hip, you're going to lose your head. Whereas if you're standing in front of your enemy and you happen to move your left hand to your right hip, nobody's going to notice because it's unexpected. That's the issue. But in addition, you get a sense that this, what is the role of this mincha?
To get close to him.
So the question is, who's planning what here? Bnei Yisrael sent a mincha through Ehud to Eglon Melech Moab. What's Bnei Yisrael thinking, and what is Ehud thinking? They're not necessarily on the same page. Bnei Yisrael is sending a peace offering or an appeasement offering to Eglon Melech Moab, and Ehud is carving swords. They're not necessarily on the same page in this case. Vayakrev et hamincha le'eglon melech Moav. They bring the offering to Eglon Melech Moav, a whole entourage that comes with pomp and ceremony, great king, wonderful, long live Eglon, king of Moav. Ish bari ma'od, very fat. In modern Hebrew, by the way, that expression has stuck. And when you talk about somebody as large, you would say bari. That's a modern Israeli idiom. You ever heard that expression?
No.
Bari is healthy. It's a euphemism. Ish bari mod.
Oh.
Right?
Well, if you say bari,
very
oh,
well. But in case of Eglon, it means that he was. He was very big, very round. Yes, it gets very graphic momentarily. And it also means he can't move very quickly. Which is to Eglon's advantage, to Ehud's advantage. Yeah, you read ahead. That's not fair. Vayhi kasher kila lakriv et hamincha, after he brought the mincha, and of course the purpose of the mincha is to say how wonderful you are and how great you are and how well. Vayishlach et ha'am minosei mincha, Ehud then turns to his rest of his entourage and he says to them, now we can go home. And the people have done their duty, they've paid their homage to Eglon. I assume this was an annual event. I don't think this was a one-time thing. I think that's part of the Avdu et Eglon Melech Moav Shmonas Veshana. They served him. They had to bring some sort of a tax or tribute to him. And here you see that in action. V'hu shav min apsilim asheret ha-Gilgal. And he, when they brought the group back to the area of Gilgal, and there was right near Yericho, which is obviously where the king is sitting. He went to this place called Psilim, which must have been some kind of location where they had an idol of or temple of some sort. He turned around. And he comes back. Vayomer, and he comes to Eglon by himself. And he says, Dvarseti Elecha HaMelech. My dear king, I have secret words for you. Meaning that he has now achieved two things. First of all, he's achieved some level of confidence with Eglon Melech Moav, which he accomplished by the gift, by the appeasement. And second of all, he wants to be alone with the king. So in order to do that, he says to the king, I have a secret for you. Presenting himself as a friend or
an official
or spy.
Emissary.
or spy. In other words, he sent all the people back. Now he's come alone. Why did he send all the people back and come alone? Before he came as part of an entourage of the official delegation of Bnei Yisrael. Now he comes to Eglon Melech Moav with secret information, and he comes by himself. If you're Eglon Melech Moav, what do you see? You see a spy. You see somebody who recognizes that we are now the controlling power, we are now the winning force, and he wants to turn sides. So he's coming to me with strategic information. Not the first nor the last time that a member of our people would side with the enemy because they were the winners in the story. Study Josephus, and that story has repeated itself many times. Vayomer has. So Eglon Melech Moav says, has, meaning. Right? What does he has? Ve'etzumi elav kol ha'amdim elav. He gets rid of all of his ministers. Right? Why? What's Eglon saying? Secret information.
He has to be alone.
He has to be alone with him. Why? Because you don't trust
anybody.
Now, you know, trust your ministers and your soldiers standing there with secret information. Ve'ehud ba'elav. So Ehud comes closer to him. And he's sitting in some sort of elevated throne. My words to you come from God. Which of course means that you have to stand, because when somebody speaks in the name of God, you must stand. Quick action, left hand, right hip. And he takes out his double-edged sword and stabs him in the belly. And here, pardon me, he stuck the sword in with such a thrust that it embedded itself with the handle in his stomach. And there was so much fat that it literally closed around the handle. And he didn't take the sword out. I don't know if he even intended to take the sword out. And out poured his guts.
He disemboweled.
They should teach this to every eighth grade student.
He basically disemboweled.
Eighth grade boys would love this story.
That is exactly what he did. He disemboweled him, and that's critical to understand the rest of the events. Ve'etze Ehud hamizdrona. Ehud then turned around, walked out the door. The soldiers are outside, standing guard. Comes behind him, closes the door. He closed the little attic where the king was behind him, and he locked it. Probably from the inside. And he walked out. Then his servants came after Ehud left the room. And they found that the doors to the king's chamber were locked. So they wanted to go in, right? Not so fast. And then one turned to the other and said, he must be relieving himself in there. Why? Because they could smell it. So they could. They certainly weren't going to go barge into the king. They assumed that the king was relieving himself. Vayachilu, I told you it gets a little graphic. Vayachilu ad bosh. So they waited till the evening. And they're still waiting and waiting. It must have had an upset stomach. Waiting, and the king isn't coming out. So they waited a long time, because the last thing in the world you want to do if you are the servant of the king is barge into the king when the king doesn't want you to barge in on him. So they waited and they waited. And in the meantime, they opened up, finally decided to go look for the spare key. They looked up, and they found him on the ground, dead, lying in his own excrement. In the meantime, no, Absolutely not. And our conclusion of this whole story is that there's a part that he planned and there's a part that he didn't plan.
He didn't plan to kill him?
He did plan to kill him.
He did.
Absolutely.
He
didn't plan. I don't believe he planned.
The fact going around the knife.
The whole piece of it, I think, was unexpected. We'll see that in a second. Ve'eud nimlat ad hitma'amam. Eud nimlat. Eud escaped. Now, I told you once about, we've had this discussion before about biblical grammar. Use of past tense. Past tense versus past perfect tense. Eud nimlat doesn't mean Eud escaped. Eud nimlat means Ehud had escaped. Why is that significant? Ad hitmamam, during their tarry, meaning
he got away.
The fact that they were waiting for the king and didn't barge back in and didn't discover the king's death until hours later is precisely what gave Ehud the ability to escape. Vuavar tapsilim. So in the meantime, he came around the same area where he had left the rest of his entourage earlier. Vayamaleta si'irata, and he ran into the mountains of Har Ephraim. Vahi bevo'o, as he ran into the mountains, vayitka b'shofar b'har Ephraim. He blew the shofar in Har Ephraim. Why the shofar? There's two references in Sefer Shoftim to the blowing of the shofar, both in the context of gathering the army. Before the before the battle, to gather the army to come for battle, to gather the army. It's exactly what he's about to do. He's about to take his army and go to battle. He blows the shofar. Vayirdu imo b'nei Yisrael minahar v'ulifnehem, and the people from the mountain came down the mountain, and he's standing there, and he says, "Acharai, charge, follow me." Vayomer alehem, ridfu acharai, come, chase after me, follow me. God has given your enemy Moab into your hands today. So they followed him into battle. And they capture the crossover of the Yarden, the area that allows easy access over the Yarden, like the bridge. Today we would call it the bridge, the area that used to la'avor to Yarden. They wouldn't let anybody go back. In other words, they cut off the army from its supply source. Remember, Moab and Ammon are coming from the east. The army is sitting here in Gilgal. If you cut off Mavrot HaYarden, you come from behind, you cut off their ability to escape and their ability to reinforce.
And they smote all of Moab, 10,000 soldiers, kol shamen v'chol ish chayel, the fat and the warriors. Meaning, Eglon wasn't the only one who didn't go to the gym. Wasn't the only Moabite to be negligent in his exercise and personal self. V'lo nimlat ish, no one escaped. But the kana Moab etahi tachat yad Yisrael, Moab was subdued under the hand of Israel that day, but Tishkot Aretz Shmonim Shana, and the land was quieted for 80 years.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't Eglon have a chance to respond? And they never really negotiated.
Negotiated with what? What's to negotiate? The man is the enemy. 18 years. He's sitting as your oppressor. You've been at war with him for 18 years. Okay. What's to respond?
Well, but there's a footnote here that when he stood up, it was a sign of respect for God, and it says he was rewarded because Ruth descended from him. Is that, it says it's Rashi. No? Okay. All right.
I have nowhere to go with that right now. I have nowhere to go with that.
True, unrelated.
Excuse me?
True, unrelated.
True, unrelated. Interesting.
One of
okay.
The choices, huh?
True, unrelated. All right. Maybe okay. It doesn't fit in the shot of the parak, but
you
I
think it's above my sense.
No, above my sense. It's a medrash, but I think it's a different approach.
Okay. All right.
I think it takes a different approach to the story. They were not in a negotiating mood with Eglon Melech.
Okay.
The 18 years of oppression had enough. But what I find most interesting is the relationship between
the role of Ehud and the mincha with which the story begins, and they spent so much time discussing.
And really, what were his intentions?
What were his intentions?
That's what interests me.
So there's essentially three parts to the story. There's Bnei Yisrael's intentions and the purpose for their sending this mincha. There's Ehud's intentions initially when he goes into Eglon's palace, and there is the result that Ehud implements. And I'm not necessarily sure they're all in consonance with each other. Bnei Yisrael is certainly in a bit different place than Ehud. I think that's clear. Where are they mindset? Where are they? They're sending the mincha. They're sending the annual, let's call it for the sake of argument, the annual tribute to the king. So he comes as part of his delegation to serve, to give this mincha to Eglon Melech Moav. And then he tells them to go home because they're not part of this plan. This plan is
his.
And his alone. Uh-huh. What do we call that? Plausible deniability? Is that the official term for it?
But he says to him that Hashem sent me and that I have worked.
That's a fake. That's just a fake. That's just to get him to stand up.
Just understand the
geography of it. He's standing below. Eglon is above him. Right? He wants to be able to get Eglon off guard and stab him from beneath. So to do that, you got to get him to stand up. How do you get him to stand up? You're saying, I speak in the name of God. Oh, so now he has to stand up. The next thing you know, he's got a spear in his belt. He's got a sword in his belly.
But he didn't expect the results of what really happened necessarily.
No, no.
Well,
what did he expect? What did he expect?
What happened when he makes this sword and puts it into a person?
Right.
What did he think of it?
What did he expect?
Well, maybe he was basically like a suicide bomber.
That's what I think. I wouldn't call him a suicide bomber,
I do think he did not expect
to walk out of that palace alone, alive.
I do not believe
he expected to walk out of that palace alive.
I mean, he would have confronted him and been killed.
But when you kill the king, especially in that world of military, you kill the king.
Especially
you, besides the fact that you're dead, but what you do is you disrupt the army, and you what are they doing now with all of their efforts in all the wars that they've been fighting both in Afghanistan and Iraq, which is trying to decapitate the leadership, because that's essentially how you get the upper hand in battle. You have to take out the leadership. Once you do that, the rest of the system is in disarray. And in the case of Ammon, this oppressive army of Ammon and Moab, the leadership is Eglon. So Ehud's understanding, he has an opportunity. He's part of this delegation to get into the palace of the king through this mincha. He's going to use this opportunity to take out the king. Is he going to survive? Is he going to walk out the door? I doubt it. But the unexpected happens. And the moment he spears him, that spear goes in so far that it disembowels him, and suddenly he realizes that he locks the door behind him. They're not going to come running in so fast. Gives him an opportunity to escape, runs into the hills, takes out a chauffeur, calls the chauffeur, and he calls the people to battle. They're not standing there. He doesn't have an army standing ready to attack the moment he takes out the king. This is all surprise. This is all unexpected. This is all recognizing the opportunity that the moment created for him, and he takes advantage of that opportunity.
The moment of the disembowelment?
So the moment he's... correct. Because it's that moment that he realizes he has an escape.
And then he locks the door.
Right. But that's why it's a critical part of the story. Otherwise, Tanakh doesn't tell us graphic detail just for the sake of graphic detail. This isn't a PG-13 or R-rated movie. This is Tanakh. The information has to be relevant. The information is relevant because it's his escape route. Now, did he plan that escape route?
No.
Maybe. I doubt it. I think that's Dafka, the part of the story that's unexpected and unplanned for. But Ehud, being who he is able to take that moment, recognize it, turn it into an opportunity to gather the army, blow the shofar, call the troops, and in an instant turn that moment of confusion, not only because Eglon is now dead, but also because without Eglon, they have to regroup the army. They have no, the army is leaderless.
We're talking about many hours.
But from morning till evening.
And one day is all you need.
Once he turned around to come back, he knew exactly how it would look out. He knew he would be alone.
Correct.
He was going to kill him.
Correct. No, that's
that
for sure.
His plan
was to kill the king.
I mean, he didn't have a set plan to say, oh, I'm going to be alone. No one's going to be with me. I'll be able to escape. He didn't think that before?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but the piece of the story that reads like a surprise almost is Vayetzer Pashtona. Is this moment where the sword goes in so far that it disembowels him. Like it reads as if that was unexpected.
But why would that make a difference in terms of the alertness of the guards to come in?
Because that's how
he's able to confuse the guards into thinking that the king is relieving himself, and therefore they're going to wait outside for a couple of hours. And I have no doubt that Eglon put a do not disturb sign on the outside of the door,
of some sort.
Clearly,
he made no noise.
Well, I mean, we don't know how, but there's nobody there, there's nobody in the room. It's not uncharacteristic of Tanakh to describe a story of a military victory that is created by an unexpected turn of events in our favor. In other words, understood that there's only so much you can plan before you need to have some kind of divine providence to assist you in implementation. Megillat Esther is probably the classic example. Because in Megillat Esther, everything's planned. Mordechai's planning, Esther's planning, Haman's planning, everybody's planning, and nobody is taking into consideration the one part of the story that could not be planned for. Meaning what? Meaning, when Mordechai says to Esther, go to the king and beg for the, right at the beginning, in Perek Dalet, he says, go to the king and beg for to rescind the decree. She says, give me 3 days. What does she need 3 days for?
Get up nerve.
Excuse me?
To get up nerve?
Maybe. I don't think so. I think she needs 3 days. She needs 3 days to research. Because what she doesn't know, and nobody knows, is how this all came about. All they know is the decree that's now been posted along every nation. They have no idea of the conversation between Mordechai and Haman. They have no idea that the signet ring is sitting on Haman's finger. All they know is what the decree says in the name of Achashverosh, signed with the ring of Achashverosh. For all they know, they don't even know who has the ring. Mordechai says, go to Achashverosh and plead for your life. And she says, not so fast. We need to research this. Give me 3 days. After 3 days, she discovers that the key is in Haman's hands. It's one thing in part of the story to discredit Haman. It's another altogether to get Achashverosh to not only distrust Haman, but to
trust
Mordechai. Because Mordechai's got to get the ring at the end of the story. One thing to wrest the ring away from Haman, you got to get it into Mordechai's hands. So she designs a plot. What's her plan? Two parties. Brilliant plan. Two parties, right? How on earth is two parties going to get Achashverosh to give, or Haman, to give up the ring? She plans two parties, and she invites Haman and Achashverosh to the two parties. To the first party. Actually, she doesn't invite to two parties. She invites to one party. What's going through her head? It's a simple question to understand Megillat Esther. Without this, it's the key question to understand Megillat Esther. Without this, the story doesn't make any sense. What was she planning when she created this party and invited Mordechai and Haman? Ahasuerus and Haman. And whatever it is that she was planning worked so well that Ahasuerus couldn't sleep that night.
But she was...
She was what?
Wasn't she showing Haman that or he was thinking in his mind that she was favoring him?
She was favoring?
Haman.
Right.
Over the king.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So this would throw him off.
Yeah. In other words, she has this private party between Ahasuerus and Haman, and I have no doubt at whom she made eyes through that entire party. Meaning that she needs to split Ahasuerus from Haman. And the only way to do that is to convince Ahasuerus that Haman is after the queen. Mm-hmm. He says it when he comes back after
right.
the second party. You're going to steal while I'm watching? He says so right after the end of the party. He goes running to Esther and falls on his couch, and Ahasuerus comes back and says, okay, off with his head. I've had enough. But in the meantime, he's now sleepless at night. He's restless. He can't figure out what's going on. Right? And he wants to calls over to his servants. He says, who's loyal to me? He doesn't know who's loyal to him anymore. His loyalty was always with Haman. Suddenly his loyalties, his loyal friends, his inside supporters are switching sides, switching allegiance. There's another piece of the story which we didn't discuss, which is how Esther got past the only rule in the kingdom, which is nobody can get past the outer chamber and into the inner chamber alive. So Esther walks in, she just walks in to the chamber, and Ahasuerus gets very nervous. What is it, Esther? Whatever you want, I'll give you half the kingdom. Just tell me whatever it is you want. He's nervous, because how did she get past the guards? The last time he checked, the only way to do that is to have the signet ring, and the ring is on Haman's finger. She invites Ahasuerus and Haman to a party, and makes eyes at Haman, and now Ahasuerus is nervous. So he discovers Mordechai's loyalty. And had everything gone according to plan, Esther the next day would have continued the charade with Haman. Ahasuerus would have realized that Haman is disloyal. He would have executed Haman. He would have taken the ring back, stuck it back on his own finger, and that would have been the end of the story. But that doesn't give the ring to Mordechai, and it doesn't give the ring to Esther. The one part of the plan that she couldn't plan for, and Mordechai couldn't plan for, was Vayomer HaMelech mi b'chatzer, in the middle of the night, when Ahasuerus can't sleep, who walks into the palace? Haman. And Ahasuerus says, oh, Haman, here in my palace, in the middle of the night? Use your imagination. Turns to Ahasuerus in the moment of the most... there's a medrash that says Ahasuerus tipeshaya. Ahasuerus was a fool. Ahasuerus is not a fool. He's presented to us as a fool. Up till chapter 6. Chapter 6, when he corners Haman, and he says to Haman, my dear Haman, what should we do to the person whom the king wants to honor? At that moment, you see how shrewd Ahasuerus can really be. And Haman says, of course, this is all about me, and he wants to honor me. So what do? You bring the king's horse, and the king's clothes, and the king's entourage, and the Medrash says the only thing that Haman left out was the king's was the king's crown, and in Ahasuerus's mind, he meant the king's queen, correct? And you put him on a horse, and you get the servant before to say, Kach yaseh li shesher melech hafetz bikaro. And Haman sitting on top of the horse, while Mordechai down below saying, this is what you do to the person who the king wants to honor, and Haman pointing to Mordechai and saying, that's what you do to the person whom the king wants to honor. At a moment of insubordination and treason that is remarkable in its depth. And Ahasuerus says, okay, I got it now. And the whole story gets turned around. Esther can plan to a point. But the piece of the story that's unplannable, where you see the Hashgacha and you see Yad Hashem, you see the moment that God intervenes, is, besides all the background, is that moment when Haman walks into the courtyard unannounced, which is the moment that nobody could plan for. And that's how all these stories operate. There's always an element of what we plan and do, and ishtadlus, and effort, and then Yad Hashem. And then there's a point where, you know, all our plans, best laid plans of mice and men, right, all our plans are there until the Ribbono Shel Olam comes in and says, yay or nay. And that's what happens with Ehud, I think, is that he really planned to execute the king. He had it all set out. He just didn't have an escape route. So the Ribbono Shel Olam gave him an escape route. And then he turned that moment into an opportunity to transform that escape route into a turn of the tide and gather his army. Maybe he had planned to gather an army afterwards if he had survived, if he could escape. But I don't think he planned to turn around that moment, blow the shofar, and gather the army. It was just the opportunity was too great to pass up, and he took it, and it rose to the occasion. That's the story of Ehud. And one last postscript, which is that if we begin to chart out the different shoftim that we have, Otniel ben Knaz is the first, Ehud ben Gera are second. Besides all the differences between them in terms of the way the story is presented, there's also a subtle difference in how they rise to the occasion, how they're appointed, so to speak. We don't know anything about Otniel ben Knaz's appointment. But Otniel ben Knaz is already a leader. He's a personality. We saw him in the story with Kalev. We saw him in Perek Aleph. He's a personality of stature. And it would be no surprise to anybody that this Otniel ben Knaz would be the one to lead the charge. Ehud ben Gera, we know nothing about. There's no background information. He's part of an entourage of peace offering. Not necessarily a likely candidate as a warrior or a moshiach. It doesn't say that God comes to him and he God appoints him and he says to him, you're it. On the contrary, it sounds like you have almost a vigilante who saw an opportunity, blew the shofar, and said, folks, follow me. And they did. And from that moment, emerge as a leader and as a personality to follow. And that's not an uncommon format either for the concept of a shofet. They don't all have to be appointed. Some of them can be self-appointed in the sense of rising to the occasion. And that too is considered Vayakim Hashem Lehem Moshiach. That too is God sent a Moshiach. It doesn't have to be explicitly sent. It can be implicitly provided by God in multiple ways. Okay, we will stop here.